Turn your tape over. I'll announce that this is the second half of that program. Regarding the summit, I'm interested in why Ronald Reagan is having it, and there's a lot of conflicts that Nancy is influencing him. And I did want to mention that all through the year, starting in 1986, I felt that Reagan was very much in a position of weakness going down all the way. I thought maybe he could be impeached. He obviously never will be touched in that sense, our Teflon president. But there were events that I felt were done to affect his presidency, and I feel that this sudden meeting and this change of mind about weapon agreements with the Soviet Union could come because it's his last chance to save face and have a presidency that's remembered at least for something. And if he goes to Russia and signs some more treaties and agreements there, that will be two summits, and he will be remembered for those. The last one was a disaster. Now, I felt the moment of weakness for this president began with Chernobyl, May the 9th, 1986, when that exploded, and 10 people in the Soviet Union were indicted for violation errors and are in jail. And I felt that we, people inside of the Soviet Union, we, our spy system, Reinhard Gehlen's system, could have done this because it was one of the most damaging things psychologically and politically that happened to the Soviet Union. Next came the Cameroon explosion, the neutron bomb, in August, a few months later, 3 months later, and I believe the Soviet Union got a message right there loud and clear because all of Europe is talking about the neutron bomb, and next week I'm going to update that for you following up this summit with the story of what's really going on in Europe. And the man who mentioned the neutron bomb in the London Times, Mordecai Vanhanou, has been secreted away, and nobody can see him, hear from him, or get any sign language to him. The men responsible for Chernobyl are indicted and locked up. Mordecai Vanhanou in Israel is not seen at all. Nicholas Daniloff was the third event that happened to Ronald Reagan and to this government. He was arrested August 31st, and we don't hear much from Daniloff. And each of these events, I did two or three or four broadcasts on, and I believe these are what led to the summit. The Reykjavik summit was called hurriedly after Daniloff was arrested and released. That was October the 3rd, and Reagan came home unprepared and damning the Russians and getting in the car and cursing, and he was literally forced to meet there, but very little was accomplished. And then 2 days later, Eugene Hasenfuss landed in Nicaragua, and the fourth man on that plane still has not been identified. That's been a year and 2 months, and the fourth passenger, I've asked Annie Sheehan and all written letters to Washington, can't find out who that fourth person was, so I know it has to be important. And then November the 3rd, the Lebanese paper Al-Shira printed the story of the United States sending arms to Iran, and the reporter who broke that story was shot in the head September 15th, 1987. So it was November 3rd, 86 that the paper had the story, and just 9 months later, 10 months later, he was shot in the head. So the Chernobyl people are locked up in jail. Vanhanou is sequestered away. Daniloff is pretty quiet. We don't hear from him. And the fourth man with Hasenfuss has never been exposed, and the reporter was shot in the head. And I believe that the victimizing of those people tied to these stories was because those were major events that affected our relationship with the Soviet Union and forced the president to come to the position he's at now. It doesn't matter how he got there, but the question is how long will it hold, given the mentality of people like Caspar Weinberger and the Richard Pearl and John Lehman and the very hard liners against the Soviet Union. I believe they've left the government to do their work on the outside, just as Richard Secord left the Air Force and was on no payroll to do his work for the National Security Council on the outside. They have things they have to account to and to Congress if they're in the government, and the very, very hardliners are leaving at this point, and they can do their damage on the outside looking in instead of on the inside having to explain what they're doing. So getting back to the material on the occult again and the problems of the origins of the occult, of these horrible things that are really difficult to understand, the story of human sacrifices and cannibalism and what's going on. There's a new book out called Aleister Crowley, The Nature of the Beast, The Life and Ideas of the Wickedest Man in the World. Now, Aleister Crowley, C-R-O-W-L-E-Y, is supposed to be the father of New Age. You hear a lot about New Age music and New Age thinking and New Age philosophy. And the one thing that you don't get in New Age is New Age politics. You can do anything but, and you can think of yourself, but you're not supposed to be thinking politically or singing politically. You can be neutralized to not have these high emotions, and it doesn't matter. The music will soothe you. The movement just gives you a introspection of yourself, but you're not supposed to be of this world or the outside. Although Aleister Crowley, the father of the New Age, so to speak, was very active in many, many ways. And in this book, on page 157, it describes Colin Wilson quotes one of his friends, female admirers, who said there was a very close resemblance between Crowley and Adolf Hitler. And this book goes into his Aquarian projects that have been compared to the way that Nazism came about and the forces and the eruption of Nazism. And this book hides, according to a review I have, the sympathies of the fascist ideology of Crowley. Colin Wilson secretly really admires him. He's written a lot of books himself on the New Age. But he quotes different parts of Crowley's life, things that Crowley wrote about. For example, his explanation of Crowley's revival says that how can you account for a man who describes his feelings as being, he died in 1947. He came to this year, to this country in 1944. But people describe his feelings as appealing to the flower power of the 1960s, the hatred of authority, the movements that led to do your own thing and even encouraged Charles Manson, the Hell's Angels. They looked to him as a kind of a god. And Wilson, in this book, quotes Crowley, who wrote a story where he says, after the World War II, there was a strong revival in the interest of occultism. And as I say, he lived till 1947, till the year the CIA was formed. He had notes that a witch in the United Kingdom, Gerald Gardner, had by the 1950s identified dozens of covens, groups of witches practicing all over England, and he said they were followers of a nature religion called Wicca. But Gardner, who was interested in Wicca and the nature religion of Wicca, was a close friend of Crowley's and an intimate of Crowley's church, the OTO, in Pasadena. Crowley authorized Gardner to set up his own magical group. Gardner liked being flagellated, and his version of Wicca laid heavy emphasis on sex rites in which everyone was nude, and they quickly gained lots of disciples. And, of course, this reminds me of Alfred Bloomingdale and Vicky Morgan and the same things that were going on with Ronald Reagan and his best friends. Very close into the White House circles, they were supposed to be part of these same parties. But Crowley's version of magic, according to this new book, was evidenced in these covens, and many members of these groups studied seriously various systems and the magic of the Golden Dawn and Crowley's own systems. Crowley also talks about, in his books, he wrote a book called Magic in Theory and Practice, where he recommended sacrificing a male child to achieve the best magical results, and added a footnote to the effect, and I don't know how true this could possibly be, that he himself had done about 150 sacrifices of children each year between 1912 and 1928. Now, I added that up, and that would be a tremendous amount of missing children that were sacrificed. But Crowley, the father of the New Age, wrote this in his book, Magic in Theory and Practice. In another section of his book, early in 1980, he gave a lecture to the Poetry Society, 1930. Crowley gave a lecture to the Poetry Society at Oxford, quoting Giles de Ray, the 15th century child murderer, whom Crowley described as a practitioner of black magic and one that he admired and quoted him, and sympathies went to this man because of his child murders. And also in this book, Mr. Wilson says that Crowley's autobiography, Crowley informs us that his mother believed he was the beast, number 666 in the apocalypse. And he said there was evidence that indicates that he was serious about the 666 and the beast, thought of himself as a counter-messiah, transcending and replacing Christ. And he used to torture and tear apart frogs and put daggers in them and call them Christ and say he superseded them and was above them and played the game of being greater than Christ. And this review of the book said, shouldn't we see in such passages the conceptual author today who's doing child kidnappings, ritual murders of children in Atlanta, Georgia, and this is one of the headquarters of the Satan group in Atlanta, Georgia, with child pornography, sexual abuse rings, and Mr. Wilson, in this book review of the book, says he doesn't bring out the Church of Satan in San Francisco, which is Michael Aquino of the Defense Department, of our Defense Department. And he has adopted Mr. Crawley's philosophy, do what thou wilt. That's the motto of Michael Aquino's Church of Set. So Mr. Crawley came to the United States in 1944, died in 1947. He was brought over here by Walter Taranti, a foreign correspondent of the New York Times. He had a strong link to Imperial Russia, to Tsarist Russia. He asked to be in the diplomatic service in Great Britain. He went to Cambridge University in 1895, was part of a cult group at Cambridge, a secret society, went to Imperial Russia, and then left Imperial Russia and came to the United States into Pasadena, California, and was sort of the father or the man behind a large number of, like, the Church of Satan and Anton LaVey. They took it over in California and in places in the United States, New Jersey and Atlanta, Georgia, and other cities, where these became the headquarters for expressing the approval of or the necessity of the mutilations of pornography and the sacrifices that were brought over here through Mr. Crawley, Aleister Crawley, who is a hero of some people, I don't know who, but a good hard study of this man from Tsarist Russia to Pasadena, California, brought in a lot of the young people, and they followed him. And what has been going on with the indifference of the, I will say, the New Age, let's take it on, the people who absolutely say, we will not talk doom and gloom. It's almost a constant brainwashing. We will only talk and think peace and harmony, no doom and gloom. And yet the very people that set up these organizations, the people behind them, have plenty of doom and gloom and run a psychological warfare operation out of the Defense Department, out of Vietnam, out of organizations like the Church of Set, and then get all those other masses of people to be perfectly satisfied with this very soft music that doesn't challenge, doesn't throw you, doesn't involve conversation or memory or anything except sitting back and being mellow and not looking at the real world that's taking place outside. Now, there's an article in 1982 on Son of Sam. I'll do more of it later. It's titled, Killer Claims He Was the Cult's Trigger Man. Son of Sam was a gentleman who went around New York City killing people in 1977-78. The article said his name is David Berkowitz. David Berkowitz claimed Tuesday that he was a designated trigger man for a 20-member killer cult dedicated to violence, depravity, sex, and murder. And the group, the Knights group up in upstate New York that I started telling about with the sacrificial murders, that was a group of 20. They're broken in to specifically groups of 20, I suppose, and Berkowitz was a member of that group in New York. He made these assertions in the deposition he gave to his attorney on a civil suit regarding the families of the people he had wounded and killed in 1976-77. Berkowitz is serving 315 years to life. He claims that he was part of a cult. Half of the cult members, he said, eventually split between male and female are now dead. There were 20 in his original group, and 10 are now dead, either through acts of violence or suicide. And a lot of this cult, satanic cult ritual, is now being explained for so many teenage suicides where families didn't even know they were part of the cult. The dead include John and Michael Carr, literally the sons of Sam Carr, his neighbor, David Berkowitz's neighbor. John Carr died in February 1978 at Minot Air Force Base. The Air Force Base was involved, if not in the murders, in the covering up. The military covered it up, and a man involved with David Berkowitz and his murders also was involved, the Manson family, and the common denominator between the two of those, and there were activities at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. The cult members were predominantly white-collar workers. 75% of them in the New York City areas were predominantly white. They killed animals as well as humans. They used hallucinogenic drugs. Although David Berkowitz bought the .44 caliber gun and ammunition for his slaying, the ammunition was kept by the cult and dispensed to him whenever he did the killings. He emphasized that he was the lone gunman on the attacks when he pleaded guilty, but he maintained that other members of his cult, three or four at a time, accompanied him as they hunted for their victims and served as lookouts for the killings. The victims were randomly picked, Berkowitz said. His cult associates assisted him in the selection process. Leipzig, whose clients Robert Violenti and Salvatore Lupino were injured in separate attacks by David Berkowitz during the summer, called on Governor Hugh Carey and district attorneys to reopen the investigation. That was 1982, and I understand that it's going to be opened again. Mr. Terry said that. Now, I mentioned several murders that happened a few years apart that were related to each other that weren't obvious at the time, but became related through different information and evidence. One murder was at Stanford campus. Several of these murders were at Stanford, three of them, and then four were related to each other. But the first murder took place at Stanford campus. A girl named Leslie Perloff, this was in February 1973, an attractive former Stanford co-ed, and she was working at the library, at the North County Law Library. She was employed as a clerk at Stanford. She was found on Old Page Mill Road, and she had been murdered, and they, as of this day, I don't think they have the person who killed Miss Perloff. And that was 1973, and I had saved articles. I was watching the instances of what is happening in California. And a woman came to me. She called me. She was doing indexing for Peter Dale Scott in the Bay Area, the writer and researcher. And around 1975, she came to me and asked me if she could help me do work and index my material and be a researcher. And I'm really pretty cautious about people coming to the house. She said she'd come down on a Sunday and meet me. I met her in San Francisco. Her first name is Julie. Her last initials are Muck. There's another part of that I won't put on the air, but I haven't seen her in years, so no purpose. First name's Julie. She had worked with Peter Dale Scott in the Bay Area. She came to my house, and instead of showing up alone, she arrived with two men, and one had a camera on his neck. And I said, what in the heck is going on here? And she said, well, this fellow, the one with the camera, he wants to stay with you. He's interested in the research, so he's keeping me company. But the other one, she was going to drive down to Point Lobos to do some skin diving. He was going to do diving off of Point Lobos. And before I could turn around, she drove away with this man and left me alone with the other one in my living room. And I sensed something was drastically wrong. They just turned around, got in the car, and drove away and left this character sitting in the living room. And I couldn't do anything with him. I didn't want to leave the room, and I didn't want to discuss the research, and I wouldn't let him leave the room. I just sat in the living room, and he sat staring at me, and I stared at him, and I was fuming at what she had done. And so anyway, she came back, luckily, left one down at the beach and came back, and I was screaming and yelling at her, why have you done this? And I was simply furious, and she took him away, and they drove away. And a couple of years later, it was a few years later, I can't remember the exact, 2-3 years later, she called and told me that she felt very badly, that she had brought him there, that he was the person who had done the killing at the Stanford campus of the Perloff girl, and she should never have brought him to my house, and that in return for her doing that, she worked with people like E. Howard Hunt, who was in the CIA formerly, and Mr. William Buckley. They were co-partners in the CIA, and she felt so badly. She said, I just have to tell you that there's going to be a house built across the street from you, and it's going to be an A-frame, and she described the architecture, and she said, I wouldn't tell you this, but because I brought him to your house and jeopardized your life, I will tell you this house is going to be here, and she described it. And about 2-3 months later, the bulldozer came, and there were two homes across the street, and a driveway was cut in between them, and a house went up there. And there's more to this story that a person moved in. She'd moved out from Texas. The purpose of that house was to keep track or tape record what was going in my home. And so when the house was all built, I went up there just to introduce myself, and on the mantle in the living room was this huge, big tape recorder, sort of like that TV movie or the movie you've seen. There's one about the cassettes and the tape recording neighbors close by, the Anderson tapes, I believe it was. And I just freaked out when I saw it. And I left my name and said hello. The woman was not home. Her parents were out here from Texas, and I had nothing to do with her. And the rest of the story someday I'll tell you about it. I'll leave it at that point. But the reason I bring it up was then, a few years later, in 1981, there was a murder at Stanford campus again. Arliss Perry was murdered, and this was the same campus. The first murder, the Perloff girl, was a few years earlier, and 1973. This is quite a few years later, 1981. And I got some calls that the same people that were involved, not the young people, there was a big age span, but some of the people involved in the murder of Arliss Perry in 1974, who was killed at Stanford campus, were the organization people behind the Perloff murder at Stanford campus, where that guy had been at my house who had done that murder. And I was told that they were connected by higher-ups at a higher level, and that there were connections between the two Stanford campuses and the two murders. And then all of a sudden articles came out linking Son of Sam to the Stanford murders, which made it a little closer to the one that had been at my home a few years earlier. And the newspapers I had on World Watchers years, a long time ago in 1981, program number 516, an article by Jack Sirica from the San Jose Mercury. That's the son of John Sirica, the judge, the Watergate judge, who was out here in San Jose. And he said David Berkowitz sat in a small interview room in Attica Prison in New York in 1979, very nervously talking to two Santa Clara County Sheriff detectives. And they were talking about the killings in New York City and what he professed to know about the brutal killing of Arliss Perry, who was stabbed to death in 1974 in the Stanford Memorial Chapel. And she had been killed there at Stanford University. And by 1979, this time period, she died in 1974, and the police by 1979 were catching on to it. In 1981, there were more articles about it. But that murder in 1974, the other one was 73. The actual murders were pretty close together. And so the time period of one killed at Stanford campus, and this guy had been at my home, and this woman who had come there to help me with the research is telling me these stories. And then later, the next murder at Stanford campus, and that one is tied into Son of Sam and Anton LaVey and the Church of Set with Michael Aquino. And just to tell you a little bit more, that I'll update more about the house and the people and the circumstances, because this is very personal. This is something I've lived with and around me since this period of 1973 and 74. It's something that I would like to give more details, but obviously you understand why I can't. I called Maury Terry. I have his phone number in 1981, and I was telling him about the Arliss Perry murder and the Perloff and the connections of the government persons that were involved and the links to Charles Manson and the Manson family and the connections of these various elements in the San Francisco, Los Angeles, California area, and Carmel, where some of these characters were members of the Manson family. My experiences with them here in California, because they were studying those problems in New York, and they involved the satanic rites and mass murders and high government officials and the military. And so I got into this very early, studying these matters because of personal experiences I was having here, and also because I continuously wanted to understand what was happening in our government. And the best way to understand it is to get know some of the characters involved. I'll tell you, it's pretty scary. Now, that book, The Ultimate Evil, I mentioned before, it's called An Investigation of America's Most Dangerous Satanic Cult by Maury Terry, and also this new one on Aleister Crowley, one of the most dangerous people in the world. This book, Doubleday, just came out this year. And this goes into extensive connections of the California-type terrorism linked to New York City and the relationship of the various persons coast to coast. Although Manson didn't know David Berkowitz, they had common denominators and people in common. So in the next weeks after Christmas, we'll go back to that. I'm going to leave the satanic and occult, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of overview of what I've lived with and dealt with in a way close by me across the street, and I don't know what to make of it. As I say, I can't say too much at this time. Last week, I referred to this Jeffrey McDonald, a physician from Princeton University who got his MD. He was practicing, and he was stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and his wife and his pregnant wife and two daughters were killed. And he was charged. He said that there was a satanic cult that came in. They left all kinds of symbols of ritualism and Satanism, and that he was cut up, and he lost these members of his family, and he lost the ability to defend himself. He was decided to be guilty. He had one trial and a second trial. And then an author came by the name of Joe McGinnis. And Joe McGinnis is a writer who wanted to help McDonald. He said, "I believe in you. I believe in what you're saying," such as the satanic cult and how the murders took place. So he got to know Jeffrey McDonald, and he talked to him for 4 years. And McDonald was sure that he was going to write a book telling his side of the story, how he's serving time and how that cult is out there doing their thing. And what happened was this man came out with a book. It was very popular for the last few years, a hardback book and paperback called Fatal Vision by this McGinnis. And instead of telling what Jeffrey McDonald told him happened to him and his family, this writer turned against him. Joe McGinnis turned against him and turned out a book and said, yep, he's guilty. And this is an interesting case because it just came before the courts. The writer was found guilty and had to give Jeffrey McDonald $325,000 because he came over under the pretense of trying to understand the case and then wrote a book that he was guilty. And last week I mentioned on the air Ted Gunderson, former FBI director of Memphis, Tennessee, of Los Angeles and Dallas, who took on the case for Dr. McDonald. And he met a woman who said she was there at the time of the murders. And since then, this FBI agent has been hiding the title of the LA Times article I mentioned last week, and several syndicated from the Dallas Morning News said, FBI agent fears probe and a plot by the satanic cult. That even a head of the FBI who was even suggested to be director, only Mr. William Webster took over, he was supposed to be the director. He was so high up. And he's been chased by a satanic cult, and the article explains that the Justice Department is protecting the people that witnesses and persons that could have been involved, and letting Mr. McDonald stay in the prison for 3 lifetime sentences, which shows how high up it goes. Well, now I'm going to conclude this part of the program and let you call in. Before I conclude, we want to thank Coast Components at 684-1185, the Monterey Bay Area's distributor of electronic components. Thank you for the underwriting grant that brought you the past hour, World Watchers. And the previous hour, World Watchers, was made possible in part by Lowdown, a leading manufacturer of microcomputer peripherals located in Scotts Valley. For more information, call 438-7400. And to remember John Lennon and his assassination that took place 7 years ago tonight, I'll conclude this part of the program with a little bit of Imagine, and then we'll continue the talk show part of the program.
Try.